Mid-19th century in America was a time of great expectation. The country was expanding and craved new lands, and it was adapting new technologies. In Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877, historian, professor, and literary critic Brenda Wineapple explores those years when the nation finally confronted its greatest moral failure, slavery, and looks into how the devastations of the Civil War and the complexities of Reconstruction would forever transform this country. Her sweeping history is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings Brenda Wineapple to our show today. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
In the past, we've talked about biographies you've written of literary figures like Emily Dickinson and Nathaniel Hawthorne. What made you take this broader historical view with this book?
Well, that's a good question. My last book, White Heat, was not just about Emily Dickinson, but it was her relationship to in his own time, well-known abolitionist who happened also to be the leader of the first federally authorized black troops during the Civil War. And because so much of that particular book acquainted me with the history of the period, and because this particular man was so involved in historical events and changes during the war, before the war, and after the war, I wanted to have a broader canvas.
Who was that man?
Thomas Wentworth Higginson.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, you haven't totally abandoned biography because you profile an awful lot of people, Jefferson Davis, Abraham Lincoln, P.T. Barnum, Walt Whitman, and a slew of others.
A slew of others, yes. And in some sense, one can say, and I would say, that history is embodied in people, that it's people who make history, whether it's Ulysses S. Grant or Abraham Lincoln at the top, or orators like Anna Dickinson, not Emily Dickinson, but Anna Dickinson, or P.T. Barnum, Walt Whitman. This range of people, an array of people, such different kinds, were all part of the same historical moment.
Although there has been a debate in the history area over whether the stories of the great men and women, right, mostly men, unfortunately, should be the way we tell the stories of history, or whether we should be talking about the people that nobody has heard of but who played an important role.
They are here, too. And so it's not just Abraham Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but there are people that you may not be familiar with, Martin Delaney, the black activist doctor. There are, Lydia Maria Child, who's known as a jingle maker and who was very active during the war, and many others whose names I won't give you because it won't mean anything. But these aren't just great men and women. They're men and women who are great.
And then there are people who I feel I should have known about, like General Narciso Lopez, a wonderful story which we'll get to in a moment.
Yeah.
Why have you called this book Ecstatic Nation?
I took the title from a Dickinson poem that begins, "The heart is the capital of the mind." And while it can be seen as a very personal poem, it's also really about a nation that is so smitten with itself, so frenzied, so excited, so believing that the sky was the limit. And in a sense, it was a tremendous time of optimism, which tragically also came in confrontation with the things that hadn't been dealt with, like slavery.
You begin with the death and funeral of John Quincy Adams in February 1848. Mm. What is the significance of that event?
Well, it's almost two things. One is it's Quincy Adams is the last connection with the Founding Fathers. Not that he was, but his father was. And there he is, an old man in the House of Representatives, come back to Congress after he was president, and he was the one who stood up against the Mexican War, and he had become in his life a fighter against slavery, and practically the last word he said as he died in the House of Representatives, he died as he lived in public service, was no. And so I thought that would be a great way to begin a book.
Didn't he also represent political change in America? For example, he broke with his party, the Federalists, partly over the Louisiana Purchase,
right,
in 1803, and over the issue of immigration, an issue that we're debating once again. In fact, a number of the things that you deal with in this book do not seem all that strange to somebody in the year 2013.
Isn't that odd? I know.
Like words like compromise.
Compromise, which is in the title because it's a word that's bandied about. It loses its meaning. It gains meaning throughout the period. And in some ways, the failure of compromise is one of the reasons, there are many, that the war was fought. But yes, back to your question about John Quincy Adams, he definitely represented change, and the change was hard to come by, certainly, and the book is about the need for change and the difficulty of change.
Because of his feelings along those lines, he had a lot of political enemies?
A lot of political enemies, absolutely. But the interesting thing is that his death, like, in a sense, Lincoln's death, there was a tremendous outpouring of love and grief. And for 1 minute, the South and the North were united in mourning that particular person. But it was the end of an era, which is why I began the book with the end of something, so we could start the beginning of something new.
Although 1848 is one of those significant years, when we talk later about 1968 being significant right. around the world, 1848 just seems, so many things seem to be happening in 48 and 49 that still resonate.
Right, I know, because if you periodize history as wars, it's the end of the Mexican War, but it's also the discovery of gold in California. It's also the Seneca Falls with the women's rights movement launching itself, really. And outside of the United States in Europe, there are revolutions promising liberation and freedom. So it's a, forgive the word, it's a very ecstatic year in many ways.
The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed on February 2nd, 1848. That ended the Mexican-American War, a war that many people think was one of the most unjust wars we've ever engaged in.
Oh, but it has competition in unjust wars. But nonetheless, yeah, what it did...
I said one of the most unjust.
I know you did. One of the things that it did is expand the borders of America. There was a lot of territory that came from that war, and that ran smack into the slavery issue.
But also, I'm curious about the way the public reacted. The Louisiana Purchase was very controversial. In fact, many people in the North especially the Federalists, opposed it. Had we come to a different place by 1848 where the United States now gains control of Texas, California, Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, and parts of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Wyoming? Was everybody happy about that?
Well, not everybody was happy about the war. There was protest against the war, for sure. Not everyone wanted that war. And as you said, many in its own time thought it was unjust. But it was over. And there was territory. And there seems to be, or was, an appetite for territory, for land that could not be sated. And even in an unjust war did provide that. And it was a place for people to settle. And it was a place to mine for riches, resources.
Was this when the doctrine of manifest destiny was first postulated?
Manifest destiny slightly before, but it's certainly, it's a term developed by a man named John O'Sullivan, and it certainly is something that carries through the entire period because you have not just the acquisition of these territories, but later an editor like Horace Greeley advising the young man to go west. So, manifest destiny is very part, I think, of the American psyche at this particular point, which is why it caught on.
How did it affect the debate over slavery?
Oh, my goodness. It was the debate over slavery. Are these new territories going to be free, or are they going to be slave states? And the South wanted, was feeling more and more embattled and more threatened by industrialization and power in the North, and they certainly wanted these particular territories to be slave states. And we talked about Cuba a minute ago. That's partly why there was an attempt to annex that country as well, make it a slave state or two.
My guest is Brenda Wineapple. Her latest book is Ecstatic Nation, published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about that. Americans are suddenly thinking that Cuba might also be a good place to acquire. What can you tell us about General Narciso Lopez and the expedition that he led to Cuba with what, 600 volunteers?
Yeah. What's interesting about that, it wasn't, I begin the book after the prologue and the death of Quincy Adams with that. And it wasn't his first expedition, but I begin with the one that ultimately failed. And one of the things that's so interesting is that he and his men, were called filibusters, and they're not the way we think of filibustering today, Wendy Davis in Texas, but rather this was a group of freebooters, really, and with covert money from certain southern gentlemen and people who'd been in government, they were able to outfit ships to go to Cuba to invade it. It's almost as if it was the Bay of Pigs, and in the hopes of surprising the Spanish, who owned the island at the time, in taking over. It's absolutely an insane endeavor, and yet it was well-financed, and lots of young boys, adventurers, whatever, freedom fighters, because they thought they'd liberate Cuba from the Spanish, were involved, and it was a disaster.
Well, I wonder about General Lopez. He's from Venezuela, isn't he?
Or yeah, and he had a very checkered past.
Well, I mean, we have other liberators in South America, and in Latin America in general, Bolivar and Martí. But they weren't supporters of slavery.
No, that's absolutely right. Quite the opposite.
So why was he saying that we should make Cuba into a slave state? Because that was the way he was going to get support? Or was he actually somebody who believed in it?
Well, it's hard to know. He changed sides so many different times in the course of his life because he was in Spain for a while and he was fighting with the Carlists and then again against the Carlists. And so he seems more or less to be an opportunist. It's possible he believed that he was going to, quote-unquote, liberate the Cubans. I think he really didn't care about slavery one way or another. I think that's the way his racism ran.
Now, Zachary Taylor had just become president. Mm-hmm. What was his reaction?
Well, he was horrified because this was a violation of the Monroe Doctrine. And, you know, he didn't want to support this at all. And he was very clear about that. It was done sub rosa with financiers, particularly from Louisiana. So he shut it down as soon as possible, and probably people in his government alerted the Spanish that Lopez and the guys were coming.
And did that help us in our relations with Spain? Because I suspect Spain felt
they
threatened
pleased,
by the United States in other situations. We had not done well by them.
No. And of course, and I think the government, then, Taylor and subsequently Fillmore, they were eager to not to start any kind of war with Spain. And they certainly wanted to turn away from really international affairs because there was so much conflict at home.
You mentioned 1848 was also the year gold was discovered in California.
Yeah.
That had a major impact on the country.
Absolutely, because suddenly two things were happening. One is a rush to California, and it's another form of expanding the country. And soon California became a state, which was very significant. And it's a whole kind of westward turn, both in terms of culture and literature. And it also augurs the decimation of the Indians because more and more settlers, white settlers from the East or in the Midwest are starting to go all the way west. So it becomes a very complicated kind of event. It also opens up the West to people who are enthralled by its tremendous beauty.
Well, Thomas Keneally, the Australian novelist, once said to me, a big difference between American history and Australian history was Americans went into the desert and then came out in the promised land. And in Australia, they went into the desert, they never came out.
Stayed. Oh, well, it depends on who you're talking to. There's promised land for some and not so much for others. You know, there were others who were unable to move, namely the, in blacks in the South, the slave population, which, there was still slavery in 1848.
This is also a time of new technologies like
Absolutely.
The telegraph.
the telegraph. There was an attempt to lay the transcontinental cable, which was very, very exciting, and suddenly the United States was going to be able to talk with Britain. It didn't really work out until the 60s, but it was interesting because there was that attempt to make connection with the broader world, but then the cable failed, and the United States almost symbolically had to look back to itself and resolve the issues at home.
Well, we had had a kind of an isolationist attitude until all of these changes.
Right.
Were these things affecting the way Americans saw their place in the world?
Yes, I think to a certain extent. There's a tremendous sense of this is a rich country. This is a country that has infinite natural sources. This is a country that's developing its own literature and culture. This is a country that is technologically very savvy. This is a country for a while where it seemed the Industrial Revolution was working. Look at the mills in New England. This was a country of, you know, tremendous opportunity where immigrants could come and people could find streets paved with gold. So it's a real sense of American significance and importance, really, at this time.
And your subtitle, as I said earlier, is confidence.
That's
a growing
confidence,
a crisis, and also compromise. Let's talk about compromise for a second. You say the United States is a nation founded on compromise.
Sure.
Have we lost that today?
Well, you know, compromise is a complicated issue because it can be seen as both a very positive thing. When you say, have we lost it today, it's as if we've lost the ability to meet each other halfway and create grounds for compromise. On the other hand, compromise also has come to mean something terrible. It sometimes seems to mean appeasement, as in the Compromise of 1850, it's a way, or in the Constitution, a way of maintaining the status quo.
The compromise in the institution being that they came up with this idea that slaves were three-fifths of a person, and also pretty much institutionalized slavery.
Absolutely.
And that was because of compromises. Otherwise, the Constitution would not have been signed by all of the states.
That's absolutely right, and that's why the Declaration of Independence became very important to the anti-slavery movement, where someone like William Lloyd Garrison is burning the Constitution and saying, in a sense, it's a covenant with death. So there you have sense, and you see this in the Congressional Globe, you see this in the newspapers, you see people saying over and over, no more compromise, no more compromise, and yet, without it, there's a headlong movement to war.
So we have a country that's founded on the principles of freedom and equality, and then the founding fathers find a way to rationalize the existence of slavery with their political and moral views.
Yes.
Didn't the northern states resist counting slaves at all?
Well, they resisted up to a point, but then you have compromises, the good and bad. You have earlier Missouri Compromise. Then the Compromise of 1850 was supposed to, in some sense, deal with the territories acquired after the Mexican War and give both the South and the North a stake in those particular territories. But it really didn't work, and it didn't work for very long, particularly because of the rider, which was the Fugitive Slave Law. And that's when the North particularly began to resist.
So the new areas covered by the Missouri Compromise, they split them up.
Yeah.
How did they determine which states would allow slavery and which wouldn't?
Well, that became an issue, particularly in 1856, when you have Kansas and Missouri both wanting to be admitted eventually to the United States, and Kansas was a free state, and Missouri, or wanted to be a free state, and Missouri was a slave state, and they're right next to each other, and you have people going over from Missouri into Kansas to change the votes, and in a sense, that's where John Brown got his start, resisting.
But John Brown comes into the story rather late. As I understand it, the abolitionists really didn't get much support in the early days in the North. In fact, Garrison was attacked a number of times in Boston. It took a while for them to get their message across.
Absolutely. And it took a long time, really.
What changed all of that?
Well, I think, as I said before, one of the things, one of the major changes was the fugitive slave law, and it almost seemed as if Southerners then could invade the North and say, take a free black as well as a fugitive and say, we're bringing you back, and there's no trial, there's no due process, there's no nothing, and we're just going to bring you back and enslave you. And then, of course, there was the Supreme Court Dred Scott decision in 1857, and what that did is say that slaves were definitely property and they could be conveyed from one place to another as if, you know, they were, I don't know, tables or chairs. And it was really appalling to very, very many people, and began to radicalize them more and more. Maybe not as radical as John Brown, but I think John Brown served, whatever you think of John Brown, he served a kind of purpose in furthering that radicalization.
My guest is Brenda Wineapple, who teaches at the New School in Union College and is the author of a number of books. The most recent, Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. It is published by Harper, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Brenda Wineapple. Her latest book, Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. It is published by Harper. In the years before the Civil War, the two main political parties in America were the Democrats and the Whigs. What were the positions of these parties on slavery?
Well, the Democrats are considered the party of Jackson. They're different, slightly different than the Democrats today. And the Whigs.
Jackson had a kind of a race. He was both a great democratizer and also a bit of a racist.
A bit.
His policies
toward Indians,
Native Americans is quite extraordinarily terrible.
That's right. That's right. And that's this particular party. And this party does become associated with the it does become associated with slavery. Let's just put it where it is. So the Whigs fall apart. They really can't last.
They were the defendants of Adams' National Republican Party.
That's absolutely right. But when the parties began, the parties keep changing in a certain sense at this particular period. It's interesting, in our era, they don't change. But when the Whigs began to collapse, they began to, what happened was you have the rise of the Republican Party. It's a slightly different party than you have today. And it comes out of the so-called conscience Whigs, because the Whigs were divided. And the conscience Whigs were anti-slavery. And you had the cotton Whigs, which were pro-slavery. Now, the Whigs were a much more quote-unquote federalist or national party. But the slavery issue really destroyed them in a sense. So the Republicans come out of that, those ashes, and some, not that many, but some anti-slavery Democrats and free soilers join to the Republican Party, which by 1860, obviously with the election of Lincoln, is pretty strong.
Well, Lincoln had been a Whig.
But
this is kind of like European politics, where a party splits because they disagree on a major issue.
That's right.
But also some of the members of the Whigs went on to form the Anti-Catholic American or
Know Nothing
Party. I've always been fascinated by anybody wanting to be part of a group called
the
Know-Nothings.
I don't know if they called themselves that, so there is that. And I think they prefer to be called the American Party. They didn't last that long. And one interesting thing about the Know-Nothings is they were, on the one hand, very anti-immigrant. I mean, they were nativists. And yet, very many of them, a number of them, were anti-slavery as well, which is a fascinating kind of mix. And the interesting thing about this period in the late 1850s is to watch everyone kind of change allegiances and colors and so forth.
Were they anti-immigrant because they were anti-Catholic?
Yeah, that was definitely part of it.
Because many of the people coming over from
Irish
and the Italians.
You had the Irish coming in, absolutely. They were definitely anti-Catholic.
Now, Lincoln has been called the Great Emancipator, but he wasn't an abolitionist, was he?
No, he was decidedly anti-slavery, and he was a politician. You know, certain abolitionists like Garrison wanted to work outside the political system, which they believed was corrupt. Lincoln was not that way. He worked within the political system. He was a Republican. He ran on the party ticket. He was a party man, and I don't mean that negatively at all. And he was anti-slavery. He made no bones about that. But he was going to work within the country and the laws that existed. His mandate was to, if he could, change the laws.
And he seemed to be willing to bend over backwards in many cases to placate the South, to the point where during the Civil War, didn't he even propose that if they would stop the war right then and there, he would allow for slavery to continue until 1900.
Oh, he was a very clever man, and he didn't mean that for a minute. What he was doing is trying to show, make the South, and Jefferson Davis show their hand, that the South had no inclination to settle, that they really wanted a separate state. So he's staking out a position to show particularly his own enemies, either in the Republicans or the Democratic Party, he's showing them that there is no possibility for a settlement. So I would never say that he was anti-slavery. I mean, I would never say that he was pro-slavery or that he was placating anybody. But well, he was very, as I said, savvy and careful, for sure.
But the South still felt that his being elected president was enough of a reason to secede and declare war. It's estimated that only 5% of white Southerners own slaves. How were they able to convince the other 95% to fight a war to ensure their right to hold another human being as property?
Well, part of the rhetoric of the time was they weren't fighting for slavery, even though that was in their Confederate Constitution, that it would be that slavery would be protected. No, the rhetoric was states' rights, was freedom, that in fact that they were being encroached upon, that the North was bullying them, and that they wanted their freedom from the country, and that it was their right. They saw themselves as the true patriots of the United States, and that they saw secession as their particular right. So it is in some sense easy to galvanize. Plus, you didn't have to own slaves to support a system as it existed.
I've been curious about recent calls for secession from a number of people across the country. Didn't the Civil War resolve that problem?
Evidently not. But one of the many things Lincoln was so brilliant about was that when he talked about secession, he really explained carefully that if you allow somebody to secede, then they can continue seceding until there's no government there at all. So that, you know, you want to secede from the United States, but then the government you form, someone can secede from that and secede from that ad infinitum, and that there's no reason for it. I mean, it's illegal, basically.
Well, slavery had been peacefully ended in many other countries, England most notably.
Right.
Didn't the Southerners feel that they were on the wrong end of history by this time?
Maybe they did. I mean, who knows what certain people felt in their hearts. And in South Carolina, in Beaufort, when the Union Army came in, a couple of people, soldiers reported that they saw anti-slavery materials in those people's houses. Whether they were reading them with passion and thinking that they were immoral, or they were reading them with disgust, we'll never know. But what one feels privately, like Mary Chestnut, I mean, clearly was very sympathetic, I think, to an anti-slavery
movement. Except she moved north.
Well, no, she was no. Oh. She was definitely. She stayed in the South during the war, and her diaries are really rather marvelous. But and her husband was fighting on the side of the Confederacy, and he had been in the Confederate government. But she knew, as you put it, that she's on the wrong side of history. But you love your home, you love your friends, you believe in what you believe.
And some slave states actually wound up joining with the North. Well, we have Maryland, don't we? And then West Virginia splits from
Virginia. Absolutely, forms a new state. In fact, Maryland was on the border and divided. There was a great deal of division, I think, probably in the southern states and probably in the northern states too. You can't assume that the entire North was anti-slavery.
Well, New York City seemed to have been very sympathetic to the South.
There you go. You know, and there was an anti-war sentiment. It's a reasonable sentiment when the total of over 750,000 killed during the Civil War, and the death tolls are astronomical for various battles, Antietam, Gettysburg. People, didn't want a war.
Why was the decision made to pardon the leadership of the Confederacy?
Well, there was only one person, Henry Wirz, who was tried as a kind of war criminal. He was the head of the Andersonville prison. I think it was the best thing to do. Maybe an analogy would be Ford. Was Ford pardon Nixon, right? I mean, that would be a kind of analogy. You want a reconciliation. You want to move on. You don't want to keep opening the wounds.
Well, a lot of people never forgave Gerald Ford for that, and I'd assume that no. Since so many people in the North had lost loved ones in the war and made other sacrifices, that they would like to see the South punished.
Well, the South was punished. I mean, it was devastated. You have to remember that most of the fighting took place in the South. And, of course, there's famous Sherman and his famous march to the sea and the famous burning of Atlanta and the famous sacking of other cities. You have to say that the South was, in fact, deeply devastated and punished and impoverished, really, by the war.
As a historian, do you think the Civil War was inevitable?
It's a funny question. Looking back, I feel that my job is to try to figure out why it happened. I think people at the time had or espoused a kind of rhetoric that made it almost inevitable and didn't really understand entirely what they were saying because they had somehow blocked out what a war might in fact mean. I don't think anything is inevitable. I think after the fact, one almost says something is inevitable to excuse it in a way or absolve it. No, there must have been other ways. You mentioned Wilberforce in England, but this country at that time could not find those other ways. And I think men and women of goodwill tried.
Well, how long after the Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse did resistance start appearing in the South? How long after the end of the war was the Ku Klux Klan formed?
It wasn't too long. I can't give you the exact date, but it wasn't. The war's over in 65. I think probably, in the next couple of years. I mean, at first there was this tension about who was going to control the South. Was it going to, in a sense, be taken over, occupied, really, by the North, by Northern troops? Was what happened in the South?
And carpetbaggers.
carpetbaggers is a funny word. It's a word I learned in high school, and they were supposed to be terrible people who came down and basically exploited the miseries of the South. Actually, the carpetbaggers was a term that was of abuse that stayed with us, and in fact, many, I think, Northerners of goodwill went down to try to do something positive in the South. One example is Henry and William James's brother Wilkie, who fought in the war, who fought in the Massachusetts 54th, the Black Regiment, and went back down south in Florida and wanted to start a farm where he used free labor.
I've always been surprised by how much the North acquiesced. To the point where Jim Crow laws eventually came into effect, and the Supreme Court voted again and again against all of the things that the Civil War had been fought for.
Right. Well, I think there was a real effort after the war from 1865 to maybe around 1876, when you get Hayes and then you get another compromise 1877. There was a real effort not to let that happen. There wasn't Jim Crow. There was a kind kind of integration. There was an attempt to redistribute land. There were black senators. There were black congressmen. There really was something positive. Jim Crow came really after with the failures of Reconstruction becoming dominant. Wasn't quite my period, so it doesn't get quite as gloomy.
We don't have any more time, but you did mention earlier that in June 1848, the Liberty Party made women's suffrage a plank in their presidential campaign, and shortly after that was the Seneca Falls Convention, I guess partly inspired by the freeing of the slaves. People felt women should be liberated.
Women were part initially of an anti-slavery movement, but of course the anti-slavery movement took over with the war, and then there's the whole story of what happens with the 14th and 15th Amendment. Women did not get the vote, as you may know, until 1920.
Brenda Wineapple will be speaking tonight at 7 at the Bryant Park Reading Room. That's in Bryant Park on 6th Avenue between 41st and 42nd Street. She'll also be reading and signing books next Thursday, August 15th at 6 p.m. at the Corner Bookstore at 1313 Madison Avenue and 93rd Street. The book, Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848-1877, published by Harper.